Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're embarking on a really fascinating mission. We're going to tackle one of the most potent and I think persistent challenges thrown down by apologists. We're talking about that claim of the impossible, you know, the idea that an uneducated farm boy, Joseph Smith, could produce this massive, complex book in just a few months.
Yeah, that challenge, it's what people often call the apologetic gauntlet, and it's incredibly effective because it immediately frames the whole debate as, you know, a miracle versus a fraud.
Right. It sort of short circuits any real thinking.
Exactly. It sets this impossible bar. But I mean, as we've talked about in our other deep dives on treasure digging, on translation, on anachronisms, we've actually gathered enough data to put together a very plausible, very human hypothesis for how this book came to be.
So we're not saying we know the exact mechanics. We weren't there. We don't know if he had notes hidden under a table or something.
No, of course not. But we can determine the sources he was pulling from, the style he used, and maybe most importantly, the actual timeline. And that's where you find the author's fingerprints.
Right.
Our goal here is to just set aside that default conclusion for a moment, the idea that this has to be an ancient historical record. If you approach the source material with a clean slate, you'll find the pieces. Well, they don't point to a miracle. They point pretty overwhelmingly to a creative 19th century composition.
Okay, so let's unpack this. I think we should start with the timeline because that really is the foundation of the whole miracle claim. You've called this standard narrative the imbalanced equation. What do you mean by that?
The imbalanced equation is, it's pretty simple, really. The conclusion that it's an ancient record is set in stone. Okay. It's immovable. So any variable a critic brings up has to be dismissed or twisted somehow to fit that conclusion.
Okay.
You see it in how they handle critics. Ted Callister, for instance, he frames the modern critical position that Joseph Smith was this creative genius using sources like View of the Hebrews as a flip-flop.
Like critics can't make up their minds. First he was too dumb, now he's a genius.
It's a classic straw man argument.
Mm.
It's just designed to poison the well.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when critics talk about Joseph's creativity, they're not saying he had a PhD. They're pointing to the fact that he had access to this incredibly rich 19th century environment.
Sources were everywhere.
Exactly. View of the Hebrews was a widely discussed book proposing that Native Americans were descendants of the lost tribes of Israel. I mean, that's a central theme of the Book of Mormon. This stuff was in the air. He had access to it.
And then you have church leadership setting the bar for the miracle even higher. We've all heard Jeffrey R. Holland's challenge to account for the origin of this heretofore unknown text.
Mm-hmm.
And Russell N. Nelson has that famous comparison to the King James Version of the Bible.
Oh, right. The 50 scholars taking 7 years, averaging about a page a day.
Yeah, versus Joseph Smith, who is supposedly translating at 10 pages a day and finished the whole thing in, what, about 85 days?
That 85-day timeline is, frankly, the biggest deception in the entire equation. It's a massive red herring. It just completely ignores 5 crucial years of preparation.
5 years? Wait, we only ever hear about the 3 months.
Well, if you go and look at the autobiography of his own mother, Lucy Mack Smith, she records that Joseph started talking about the plates and their contents all the way back in 1823.
Wow.
That's a full 5 years before the main dictation with Oliver Cowdery even began in 1829.
So he wasn't just sitting around waiting for a scribe. What was he doing in that time?
His mother gives us the key context. She says that almost every evening, their family would discuss the ancient inhabitants of the Americas. Joseph was describing their dress, their cities, their warfare, as specifically as though he had spent his life with them.
He's workshopping it.
He is workshopping and rehearsing the entire narrative, the characters, the plots, the theology, for half a decade. This completely changes the context from some kind of sudden, miraculous revelation to a long, slow, creative incubation.
That makes the 3-month dictation period feel more like transcription than creation. And we can't forget the 116 lost pages. The Book of Lehi.
Right.
I mean, that was a disaster for him at the time, but it gave him a crucial rehearsal.
A do-over, exactly.
Yeah.
Losing those pages forced him to refine his process, to smooth out theological issues, and to make sure the second attempt, the small plates of Nephi, flowed a lot better.
Okay, so if we accept there were years of prep time, let's go back to that impossible dictation speed. The book is, what, about 270,000 words?
Roughly, yeah.
To get that done in 85 days, you'd need to dictate around 3,200 words a day.
And that still sounds really fast, until you actually apply real-world metrics. John Hamer and others have calculated that an average dictation speed for clear handwriting, which is what Oliver Cowdery was doing, is about 1,200 words an hour.
So do the math. That's 2 hours and 40 minutes.
That's it. 2 hours and 40 minutes a day. The whole image of Joseph hunched over a seer stone, sweating for 12 hours straight in some stream of inspiration. It just collapses. This schedule gives him plenty of time for breaks, for planning, for preparing the next chunk of material he was going to dictate.
And we can cut down the amount of unique content he had to create even more if we look at what's actually filling up the pages.
Right. You're talking about the filler. If you analyze the text, direct quotes from the King James Version of Isaiah make up 14,767 words.
Wow.
That's 5.3% of the entire Book of Mormon that he didn't have to create. He just quoted scripture he already knew.
And then there's everyone's favorite filler phrase.
It came to pass.
Yeah. Yes.
That accounts for another 5,904 words, or about 2.15% of the book. So between just those two things, recycled KJV text, and that one repetitive phrase, you've got nearly 10% of the entire book that isn't unique creation. The speed claim is just, it's totally inflated.
So if the speed claim is inflated, let's talk about the quality. I mean, the miraculous claims are about the modern, edited, sleek version. What did the original text actually look like?
The original manuscript, which anyone can look at thanks to the Joseph Smith Papers Project, reveals a dramatically different product.
How so?
It was dictated in these big block paragraphs. No chapters, no verses, no section headers. It was just full of run-on sentences, awful spelling, folksy language. It was messy. It was made readable later by editors and typesetters. We're arguing about a text that was, frankly, pretty clumsy in its original form.
Wait, so the text people are holding up as proof of ancient genius is actually the cleaned up 19th century edited version? That's a huge detail.
It is. And the very nature of the errors in that original manuscript points to oral spontaneous dictation. You can see the author catching himself in real time.
Do you have an example?
Yeah, Mosiah 16.6, Joseph dictates, "And now if Christ had not come into the world," but that's a mistake because it's a pre-Christ narrative. He immediately realizes his error and adds a correction right there in the sentence, speaking of things to come as though they had already come.
That's a verbal scramble, like someone trying to recover mid-sentence.
Exactly, or in Alma 24.1, changing weapons of peace to weapons of war for peace. These little verbal fixes are strong textual fingerprints. They show an author creating content on the fly, orally.
Okay, let's use that idea, the author weaving things together, to deconstruct one of the most famous examples of supposed advanced knowledge, the Jacob 5 allegory. It's often praised for its complex understanding of Mediterranean olive horticulture.
This is a perfect case study of what we call bricolage, or source conflation. Joseph Smith basically pulled from two completely separate biblical passages, and in doing so, he created a huge anachronism and, honestly, a narrative mess.
Okay, what were the two sources?
Source 1 is from the Old Testament, Isaiah 5, which tells the parable of the vineyard. Source 2 is from the New Testament, Romans 11, which has Paul's very sophisticated discourse about the olive tree and grafting.
And the problem is,
the allegory starts out with the olive tree metaphor, clearly pulled from Paul's New Testament writing. But then, halfway through, when it starts quoting Isaiah, the text suddenly switches the entire metaphor and begins talking about the vineyard itself. The author loses track of which source he's pulling from.
And the chronological blunder is just massive.
It's huge. He's using Paul's New Testament letter, written decades after Christ, inside a text that's supposed to be pre-Christ. The sophisticated theology of the New Testament is appearing centuries too early. You can't read Jacob 5 and not see the scenes where Joseph stitched two parts of the Bible together.
That's a really powerful fingerprint. Let's look at another one, the Malachi anachronism, which is tied directly to the 116 lost pages problem. This gets a little confusing, so let's slow this one down.
Okay, so this is a beautiful example of how the replacement text exposed the author's memory problems. The book of Malachi was written centuries after Lehi left Jerusalem. So the early Nephites shouldn't have had it.
Right.
And in 3 Nephi, when Jesus visits the Americas, he explicitly confirms this. He says, "These scriptures which ye had not with you the Father commanded that ye should give unto you." And then he quotes Malachi.
So Jesus himself confirms that Malachi wasn't on the brass plates?
Correct. But here's the sequencing problem. Joseph dictated 3 Nephi the part with Jesus relatively early in the process. Later, he dictated 1 Nephi and 2 Nephi, which was the replacement text for the 116 lost pages.
Ah, I see where this is going.
When he was dictating 1 and 2 Nephi, he was eager to use these powerful phrases he knew and liked, like Malachi's, "All the proud shall be stubble." He puts those phrases right into 1 Nephi and 2 Nephi. He completely forgot that he had already dictated a later section where Jesus explicitly said those scriptures weren't available to the early Nephites.
Occam's razor, right? The simplest explanation is probably the right one. It's so much simpler to conclude that a 19th century author just mixed up his dictation sequence?
Than to believe that ancient redactors, Mormon and Moroni, painstakingly etched those memory lapses into gold plates? Absolutely. The sequencing of the errors confirms 19th century authorship.
This all brings up a bigger question. Just how much of Joseph Smith's own life, his own 19th century world, seeped into this text?
A tremendous amount. You have to remember the atmosphere of the 1820s. It was the burned over district. It was just saturated with religious revivals. Methodist sermons were everywhere, loud, dramatic.
And when you look at King Benjamin's sermon in the Book of Mormon, the whole setup is a perfect mirror of those Methodist camp meetings.
It really is. You have a Reverend Benjamin preaching from a tower or a stage. People are gathered in tents. And critically, they're literally falling to the ground to commit, which was a signature feature of 19th century Methodist revivals. That's not ancient Jerusalem. That's upstate New York in 1820.
And there was a preaching technique at the time called laying down heads, right? Where a preacher would use a few notes to expand on for hours.
And that technique is actually written into the Book of Mormon itself. In Jacob 1.4, Jacob is commanded to engrave the heads of them upon these plates and touch upon them as much as it were possible. That's a 19th century rhetorical technique, laying down heads, codified as an ancient religious mandate.
Okay, so let's tackle the last big apologetic hurdle. The claim of hundreds of unique names and places that are just too complex to be made up on the fly.
This myth, it just loses steam as soon as you analyze the frequency of the names. I mean, sure, main characters like Nephi are mentioned thousands of times, but most of the other unique names are mentioned once, maybe a few times, often in the very same verse or chapter.
Oh, really?
Take the name Jared. He's mentioned 20 times, but all 20 mentions are in the single chapter of Jacob 1.
So Joseph only needed short-term memory during one dictation session to keep track of a name he just invented.
Exactly. It's a structure that aids memory for oral creation, not a sign of complexity. And many of the key names have clear external parallels. Nephi, for instance, comes directly from the Apocrypha, specifically 2 Maccabees, which was printed in Bibles of his day.
And the local connections are pretty striking, too.
They really are. Names like Laman and Lemuel directly parallel people in his immediate circle. Laman Walters and his uncle Lemuel Walters were his known treasure-digging associates. Joseph was a sponge. He picked up names, ideas, and theology from everywhere around him.
So let's bring all this source material together now. The textual evidence, the anachronisms, the historical context. When you look at the whole picture, what's the unified conclusion?
I think the conclusion is that no one but Joseph Smith could have written this book. It has 19th century errors, 19th century theology, 19th century sourced biblical material, 19th century preaching methods.
Yeah.
It's a unified product of its time and place.
And the most compelling proof of that comes from a contemporary witness, not a modern critic.
Alexander Campbell was a major religious leader in 1830, and he saw the book the moment it was published. He noted that the Book of Mormon contained every error and almost every truth discussed in New York for the last 10 years.
So he saw it immediately.
Immediately. Campbell saw that the book was basically written to resolve all the big theological fights of the 1820s. Infant baptism, the Trinity, Freemasonry, Republican government.
It really is a theological time capsule, perfectly solving the problems of Joseph Smith's world.
It is. And yet, if it was really a book for our day, as the church claims, it's totally silent on the big ethical issues that blew up just a decade later. Things like polygamy, the Nauvoo theology, women's rights, slavery. It resolves the controversies of 1830, but not 1840 or 2024.
So this deep dive has, I think, established a really powerful and plausible hypothesis grounded in the source material. Joseph Smith composed the Book of Mormon over years, not months, by weaving together the Bible, 19th century religious ideas, his own life, and contemporary preaching techniques.
And if the Book of Mormon is, as Gordon B. Hinckley once said, the keystone of the religion, it has to be exactly what it claims to be, an ancient, untainted record. But the evidence we've covered shows that when you start with a clean equation, the answer points overwhelmingly to 19th century composition.
Which leaves us with that core binary, based on Hinckley's own challenge. If the book isn't what the church claims, then it is, in his own words, the biggest fraud perpetrated on mankind. We've laid out the facts and the fingerprints. Now, you have the knowledge to weigh that evidence for yourself.
I'd really encourage you to go look at the original manuscript notes, check the word frequency charts, review the comparisons between Jacob 5 and the Bible, the puzzle pieces. They really do fit together. And the picture they create is one of human creative genius.
Thank you for joining us for the deep dive. We'll see you next time.